Welcome to As a Woman, Fertility Hormones and Beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Natalie Crawford, and I am a board-certified OBGYN and fertility physician, and also co-founder of Fora Fertility in Austin, Texas. Each week on this podcast, I discuss health and fertility and how they relate to your true self. Become a part of the community of collaboration that amplifies others as a woman. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome back to the As a Woman podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Natalie Crawford. Today we are doing a Q&A episode all about IVF. Now, the Q&A episodes are my absolute favorite. I feel like it's such a great way to really get to the bottom of some of those questions because you can watch videos, you can listen to podcasts, you can read posts online, but nothing dives down to maybe answering the question that you have like asking it. We're going to dive right in to answer some of your questions. The voicemail you can call if you'd like to ask your questions in the future is 657-229-3672. Again, that is 657-229-3672. Now, I also put a question box every Monday on Instagram at Natalie Crawford MD. Those questions will be answered right there on Instagram, here on some of our other podcast episodes, in our weekly For Fertility Sake Q&A segment, and you'll find some in the newsletter. Feel free to check out the website at nataliecrawfordmd.com, where you can sign up for the newsletter, where you can learn more about the courses, and there's even a resources tab where you can search and find all the content I've made on your particular topic of interest. So we're going to go ahead and dive on in.
Hi, Natalie. Love your podcast and YouTube. They really helped me educate myself during the long waiting period for IVF. My husband and I are both 28. My husband has male infertility. The first two tests showed too few to count for sperm, so he's been on Clomid for about 8 months now. We saw his numbers increase, so we were able to go through with an IVF cycle this fall. And we actually recently found out that his sperm that day counted at 3.5 million, which we thought was pretty crazy. But my only identified issue fertility-wise was a prolactin level of, about 32, which resulted in an MRI where we found a small prolactoma. So I'm on about 0.25 milligrams of cabergoline weekly to keep my prolactin around 3.67. Our IVF cycle, it was doing well. Day 9, my LH was 3.66. Progesterone was 0.66. So they had me weigh again and test on day 11. I had 30 follicles. Mean size of the largest few was about 19 and 18.2 millimeters. But on day 11, my progesterone had raised to 3.35, and my LH was at 9.35. Throughout this, my estrogen, I think, raised to, 3,600 on day 11. I triggered night of day 11, and egg retrieval was day 13 morning. They collected 23 eggs of the 30 follicles, and 11 of those eggs were mature. 8 fertilized, and 1 made it to the embryo stage. A few of my questions were, why did my progesterone rise so suddenly, and how could this have affected my cycle and our results? We were expecting about 75% of the eggs to be mature, and less than half were. What could have caused this? And we were assuming only one making it to blast large enough to freeze is due to low sperm quality, and are just curious what we could do differently the second time we do IVF. The doctor has recommended growth hormone and Provera with cetratide to help. Thanks.
One, I'm so sorry that the IVF cycle has really brought more questions, especially going into it feeling that you just have a male factor and that everything else will be okay. Protocols are sometimes tough. It does sound like you had a meeting with your doctor, which is always the number one thing I recommend, that WTF, either meeting or note. Sometimes I just send a detailed message to my patients, breaking down the cycle, and sometimes it's a visit. Everybody's style is a little bit different, but you want somebody to go and look through what is happening. When we're following follicles throughout a cycle, we have to think about the job of a protocol. The job of the protocol is to get all of the eggs that are available in that month to grow to maturity together. So we'll say you had 30 eggs available in that one given month, and our job is to try to get them all to grow together. Notably, that's going against what your body wants. Your body wants all of those eggs to not grow and just have one grow. Have one egg grow, lead the way, everything else die. So we're trying to go against the normal brain-ovary communication. So my thought is the job of a protocol is to get as many mature eggs as possible. Didn't happen in this case. What are we going to do about it? Number one, sometimes you can look at what you do before the cycle starts. So if we consider the start of the cycle, when you start the gonadotropins, like the FSH and the menopure, what did you do beforehand? So did you do anything? Did you start on your period? Did you do progesterone? Did you do estrogen? Did you do birth control pills, Lupron? There's a whole lot of different options we use for suppression. If you didn't use anything and you went off a natural period, I would say number one, you didn't have a synchronous cohort. That would obviously be something I would consider. Number two, I don't check progesterone values in an IVF cycle anymore. We used to check estrogen and progesterone, especially when we were doing a fresh transfer. And maybe that was part of your team's original plan. If you're trying to do a fresh transfer, you will check it because you want to make sure that the lining is still acceptable, that it hasn't been exposed to hormones early. And if the progesterone was rising, for example, then you would not be a candidate. It wouldn't be a good situation for a fresh transfer. But in a cycle where you're not doing a transfer, where you know you're freezing the embryos, I no longer care about that value. And so I'm not checking it. People tend to act on labs. Your estrogen got really high, your progesterone started to raise, and went ahead and did a trigger shot. And I see this all the time, even on estrogen alone. But by looking at the size of the follicles, it's pretty obvious that they're not going to be mature. Occasionally, the size of the follicles looks like they are going to be mature. And just for you, you mature at a bigger size. So what were the size of your follicles? Were they in the mature range for that protocol? Do you need to be triggered at a bigger size follicle? Or simply, were you triggered? And this was actually the expected outcome. Based on their follicle sizes, you're only going to have a mature. And sometimes it's really hard, but you look back and that's really clear. So ignoring progesterone values, if you're using an antagonist cycle specifically, you're blocking ovulation and you can do a Lupron trigger, which will allow you to prevent the risk of hyperstimulation and you can push the follicles bigger and you can push that estrogen level higher without worried about hyperstim. If we are worried about hyperstimulation, maybe you're on a Lupron protocol and your estrogen starts rising, sometimes we do get our hand forced and have to trigger you because we can't keep going. So this is why every situation is unique. But certainly, if there were 30 follicles being measured, only 23 at retrieval, but only 8 mature, huge disconnect and obviously a room for improvement. So knowing the sizes, looking at the full picture, that can be really helpful. Knowing what type of protocol you're on. If you weren't on an antagonist protocol, maybe you could be on one in the next cycle and not be as worried about that rising estrogen. I'm also always looking at how many of the eggs that were not mature were over mature, under mature, and if they were under mature, were they M1s or were they GVs? Scientific terms, but essentially if we think about it, when the egg is getting ready to fertilize, it has to go through two stages of meiosis. Meiosis one, meiosis two. M2s are the ones that can be fertilized. Those are the mature ones. Those have gone through meiosis two. M1s are close. These were close in size. These were close. Maybe they just needed a little bit longer trigger time. So did your clinic do 35 hours or 35 and a half or 36? And were they GVs, which just means they were really remote from maturity. They really just needed to get bigger. If they were degenerating, on the other hand, then they might have been over mature. So if you had follicles super big. You also have to look at, and you didn't say this, but just when I'm going through my brain or if I was going through these records, did you ovulate at the time of the retrieval? So were you starting to ovulate? Is that why the number retrieved wasn't quite as high as they were measuring? That would play into what protocol you might feel comfortable doing a next time. Now, when we have about 2 million sperm that are moving in the sample, we really feel like that should be sufficient for IVF. I presume they did ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where you take a sperm and you put it inside each egg. Really standard for male factor. If you didn't, though, do ICSI, this would absolutely be a scenario to consider it. Now, when we look at fertilization rates, so all 8 eggs are not going to fertilize or make it to blastocyst. So typically you see about 75-80% fertilized, so let's say 6, and then half of those should make it to the blastocyst stage. So we would expect 3 and you only had 1. what can go on there? That can be egg quality, that can be sperm quality. So doing what you can do as far as limiting toxins for sperm. I have that whole last episode about it. Healthy eating, vitamins and supplements, not smoking cigarettes or marijuana or drinking, getting sleep, doing what you can. And from egg quality as well. If they're concerned about egg quality, this is where the growth hormone addition is coming on. I don't disagree with it after getting unexpected poor results. But if they are concerned about egg quality, what about dietary lifestyle changes for egg quality? Is there anything you can be doing? Sometimes we see that we don't do average in culture. Average is just that. Some people do better, some people do worse. And sometimes we get answers to our own infertility along the way. It is not fun. It stinks. But in the big picture, if we're having a hard time making embryos at a young age, it adds to the argument that doing IVF now is helpful. And that if you can do another cycle, if you can really try to batch up embryos so that you can have more than one child, if that's a goal of yours, certainly has to enter into the discussion because it might only get harder as you get older. So I always look at, is your care team going through these different things, evaluating the protocol, recommending changes? Sounds like they are recommending some changes, so that's ultimately good. You're never wrong to go get another opinion and get these records in front of somebody else's eyes. IVF is so expensive. It's emotionally and physically taxing. And at the end of the day, we don't have 100% success, which is so, so hard. So knowing why the choices are being made for you and feeling confident with your care team and your doctor is so important. Ultimately, sounds like there's room for improvement, and I tell this to every patient who I give a second opinion to. If I sit here and say, there's nothing I would do different, I will do that exact same cycle again, I have no reason to expect a different outcome, that is a lot harder pill to swallow than I want to change this and this, and maybe we can try this or add on this or push to this size or do this protocol. Those little changes, even though they may sound small, can actually go and make a big difference. So wishing you a lot of luck on your next cycle. And now a word from one of our sponsors, Quince. The weather's getting warmer, so it's time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and hello to shorts and tees. I wanted to update my wardrobe for the long haul without spending a fortune. And luckily, I found Quince. Now I've got a lineup of timeless pieces that keep me looking effortlessly chic year after year. The best part is that Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, but Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the cost of the middleman, passing the saving to us, and only working with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices. I personally cannot wait to wear my cute tan linen set this summer. So it's your turn to get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/AAW for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/AAW to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/AAW. Thank you, Quince. And now a word from one of our sponsors, Ritual. Did you know that women were excluded from clinical research policy by federal law until 1993? But women belong in scientific research. They're essential, and Ritual knows this. I choose Ritual multivitamin every day because it is easy to take, and I know that I am getting high quality and traceable ingredients in a clean and bioavailable forms. In fact, Ritual conducted a university-led human clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy, and the results showed increase in vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. No more shady business. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin that you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/AAW. Start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/AAW for 25% off. Thank you, Ritual. All right, before we go to our next question, a quick reminder that the voicemail is 657-229-3672 to call and leave your question.
Hello, this is Dr. Beeman. We are calling you from Australia. I'm trying with my wife. She's 34 years old now, to get a baby through an IVF. Her latest blood test, the FSH is 18 on the second day of period, and the estrogen is 76. Her AMH is less than 0.3. She is a very low one. We did previously an IVF cycle with high dose of estrogen. The longer protocol was similar. High dose of FSH, but the cycle is canceled. So what do you think? Should we go for another cycle and three cycles to get the, what she needs? Or do you, we just need one baby? Do you don't need more than that? Or do you think that her high FSH is 18 and estrogen is 76 on day two of the period means that she is now very hard to get at, or she is around menopause? And do you think her, she's still just in diminished ovarian reserve, or now she is ovarian failure and menopause? Her this low AMH is now around 18 months. We know this very late. We did one previously, and something happened. We didn't go through very early. So, what do you think? Please, we need to know your answer. Thank you.
What we know from FSH and estrogen values, which are checked in the early follicular phase, so typically cycle day 2, 3, or 4, is that they're telling us what is communicating between the brain and ovary. So when the brain and the ovary are both high, the brain is sending out more FSH to get an egg to grow. That means there's fewer eggs. And when your estrogen is high, that means your egg is starting to grow fast, which also means there's fewer eggs. I always say that the ovary is more stubborn as we get older. And this just means it takes more trial and error. Finding that protocol to get the correct response is harder. Our body gets so set in its ways, and the brain and the ovary really want to just ovulate that one egg. And so seeing cycles canceled, especially for a single dominant or a low response, is common when we get into this diminished ovarian reserve. Being age 34 means that our egg quality is still good, or overall should be still good. We always have to think about the following. One, why do we have low ovarian reserve? Do we know? We don't always know. But things like endometriosis, other inflammatory diseases, exposure to chemotherapy in the past, genetic diseases. Do we carry fragile X or have an abnormal karyotype? Do we have any autoimmune disease? These are things that we know can contribute to diminished ovarian reserve, especially at a young age. And 34 is a young age. So in my young patients with low ovarian reserve ask me if they should keep going. It's all about your goals. Is it going to be a marathon? Yes. Is this the time? This is the moment. Yes. This is the time to know with confidence you did what you could do. And maybe it was that one cycle. But most people feel like they want to at least try to get something in the lab. And so one protocol didn't work and got canceled. That's okay. Let's try other protocols. Try something different. See if a different situation and circumstance can get it there. When do we feel like an FSH is absolutely too high? Typically, if it's getting over 40, you're not having periods. When you're getting into that stage, it's going to be hard to get you to respond to FSH if your ovary's already seeing an FSH of more than 40 and not responding. So your FSH is high, yes, but we do see a natural response. Also feel like this is a situation where I personally feel like if you're body is sending out a strong signal of FSH and you're growing an egg quickly out of the gate, we really want to come in and suppress you to drop that FSH down. Therefore, your ovary can see that synchronous rise of FSH from the stimulation. So this is where I don't love doing protocols that come off of your natural cycle, unless it's the only option available. So the question was, should you give up? That's not my decision to make. Medically, from the data I have, would I tell my patient to stop? No. I would say, if having a genetic child is a goal, absolutely, I would keep going if you can. Let's try other protocols. We haven't tried everything. At some point, might we say, hey, I've tried everything I have, all the tools that I have, and it's not going to work. I do. I have and I do. If you said, we want a baby, a genetic child is not the ultimate goal. We want a baby and we want to do the thing that's going to help us have a baby the fastest or the cheapest, that very well might be donor egg or donor embryo IVF. So making sure that you understand what those choices are, how much they may cost if they're available to you, and that you keep that door open. But you could do donor egg in 10 years. There's zero way you'll be able to do autologous IVF with your own eggs in 10 years. So this would be the time that I would try other protocols and keep going, do everything I can for the egg quality and sperm quality. So really lean in to those lifestyle factors, all with that mindset of lowering inflammation. So getting good sleep, trying to eat really healthy, lots of nutritious foods and vitamins and supplements, and avoidance of toxins, so that no matter what, you at least can feel like you're doing what you can. Sending you lots of love.
Hi, Dr. Crawford. My name is Rebecca. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast, and especially just the importance you have placed on, you know, taking care of our hormones and making sure just how important estrogen is to the body. And I just really appreciated that. I was diagnosed with, hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. And so I'm in the middle of my first IVF cycle. So this has just been really it's so nice just to hear you talk about it. And I love my clinic and where we're doing, but I was wondering if you'd had patients like that before and if you've ever recommended anything just to help. I know the importance of estrogen, and so I just know I'll be on estrogen probably as long as I can, but anything for that missing FSH and LH, if there is something that, you know, you ever recommend patients taking them when they're not in the middle of an IVF cycle, just kind of thinking ahead to the next egg retrieval and wondering if there was something that helped those FSH and LH numbers, because I know how important that is to egg quality. But thank you so much, and we'll be tuning in.
All right, so hypogonadotropic hypogonadism means that your estrogen is low. Hypogonadism, your gonads for you or your ovaries, they're not making estrogen, which is their primary hormone. And they're not making it because you have a low level of FSH and LH, the gonadotropins, being sent out of your pituitary gland. This is also from the hypothalamus. So hypothalamic amenorrhea, hypo, it all gets very confusing, but we can just say hypo. The short answer is that the reason why you have low FSH and LH is that they are not getting stimulated to be released from the pituitary gland from GnRH, gonadotropin releasing hormone, which is in the hypothalamus. Why? That's the key to your question. To answer the second area, to get to the end and come back to the beginning, estrogen is really essential for your brain, your bones, your body, your sex life, for so many normal functioning. It is not normal to be hypoestrogenic for long periods of time. We will do it for short periods of time in fertility treatment or at certain times. Like when you're breastfeeding, you have very low estrogen and it serves a purpose in that piece in time. But overall, it can have very serious health consequences and seriously impact your quality of life. So props to you for knowing that you need estrogen replacement. When we do IVF, and often IVF is the sole or the best option for fertility treatment, the reason why is because we can give you those gonadotropins. That is the medications we use to get the eggs to grow. So we're going to give you shots of FSH and LH to stimulate multifollicular development. Medications like Clomid and Femara don't work because they require your brain or your hypothalamus to interpret that your estrogen has dropped and subsequently tell the pituitary gland to send out more FSH. And that connection's broken, so that's not going to work. So that's why we've got to come in with these gonadotropins, and that's what IVF is. And now a thank you to one of our sponsors, Rocket Money. If you have been following, you know that I'm a fertility doctor, and at Fora, we just opened our own IVF lab. So I've been trying to save money because that's expensive. But it seemed like my bank account was absolutely stuck. So thankfully, I heard about Rocket Money and gave it a try. And it turns out I had a bunch of subscriptions that I was paying for that I have been too busy and I have forgotten about. Rocket Money helped me cancel some of them, and that is just making me feel so much better watching my account balance go up. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when they use the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/AAW. That's rocketmoney.com/AAW. rocketmoney.com/AAW. And now a word from one of our sponsors, Apostrophe. With the temperature starting to warm up, I'm so excited that summer is around the corner and getting ready and looking forward to the summer months. But I know that when I'm outside enjoying nature, I need to pick up supplies to prepare myself for summer adventures. And if you want to get your skin glowing in time for summer, it's time for you to get started with Apostrophe, who is sponsoring this episode. Apostrophe's goal is to help you feel confident in your own skin. So whether you're dealing with breakouts, signs of aging, or acne scarring, Apostrophe will help you love the skin you're in. I personally love that you get access to an expert dermatology team, a tailored treatment plan. It's simple to sign up for your first visit, and there is no in-person appointment or trip to the pharmacy needed. We have a special deal for our audience. Get your first visit for only $5 at apostrophe.com/AAW when you use our code AAW. That's a savings of $15. This code is only available to our listeners. To get started, just go to apostrophe.com/AAW and click Get Started. Then use the code AAW at sign up and you'll get your first visit for only $5. Thank you, Apostrophe, for sponsoring this episode. So IVF can be a very, very successful thing for people who have hypo-hypo. Other countries, not the US, have been studying and working on a pulsatile GnRH pump. One of the hardest things about it is that these hormones aren't released one time a day or how you take a pill. They are released in pulses, and the pulse frequency and amplitude determine what is being sent out. So I always say it's like Morse code is happening here. So it's so hard to replicate that in taking a shot or taking a pill because we're overriding the system. When it comes to IVF, we can give you this big bulk dose, and that's okay because we're achieving a different goal than what your question might be is, can I make my body make FSH so then it can make estrogen and I can feel normal? And the truth is, that's not science that we really have available to us, especially not in the US. We hope to. That would be amazing if you could make hypo-hypo patients, if they're able to have a GnRH pump, like somebody might have an insulin pump, and that we could control the frequency and amplitude to get them to ovulate. Amazing. But right now, what we're looking at is that you'll do IVF, use gonadotropins to get eggs to grow, go through an egg retrieval. The ovaries work fine. They're just not being stimulated. So after the egg retrieval, they will then still make progesterone, and then you'll get a period. Very often, we'll go and put you on birth control pills in between cycles, just to put you in a nice holding pattern. The combined birth control pill is a combination of a progestin, various different types, pending the type of pill, and ethanol estradiol. Ethanol estradiol is not the same as the estradiol made from the ovary. It won't even show up on an estradiol blood test. But it is enough estradiol for parts of your body, like your brain and your bones, to be getting what they need and to not have you in a hypoestrogenic state. That is easier for us, getting you into another cycle or getting you into an embryo transfer, than temporarily putting you on estrogen. Although some of my patients who are hypo-hypo or don't have ovaries, different scenarios, I will sometimes just put them on estrogen, but then you'll have to cyclic in some progesterone to get them to bleed. And often we're waiting on results. We're not sure of the timing. And to keep the train moving, birth control pills are often the simplest answer to get from point A to point B. The bigger question is, why do you have hypo-hypo? Very often it is truly from a stressor on the body that was so intense that your body decided it wasn't a safe space to become pregnant, meaning calorie deficiency, over-exercising or training for some huge exercise event, chronic illness, chronic inflammatory disease, potentially an autoimmune disease, head trauma, brain injury, brain tumor. So there's a real big span there, right? From brain tumor to training to a marathon. We should never accept the diagnosis without clearly knowing what's going on. Meaning, oh, I'm a competitive gymnast. Okay, we got a good reason. But for somebody to say your hypo-hypo is due to stress and you didn't have any imaging of your brain, that makes me nervous. Doesn't mean that it wasn't stress, but saying that your stress was so much that your brain shut off the connection from the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland meant that it was a huge, huge stressor. And we do need to rule out physiologic causes like the brain tumor. One of my most classic cases, or a patient who always stays with me, is somebody who was at a concert and fell down and had a brain injury, had a concussion, and had a Mirena in place, no big deal. And then a couple of years later had the Mirena removed and then never had period, and then thought it was because of the Mirena, because that's a progesterone IUD and they didn't get periods on the progesterone IUD. So it's just going to take a while. So they wait 3 to 6 months, but they feel terrible. Brain fog, low energy, miserable. And periods don't come back. End up coming to me, and when we check blood, we actually find out that our brain is not sending out FSH and LH, even though this incident happened 2 years ago. It's not anything to do with the Mirena. That was just a big red herring and why we didn't catch this closer to time of incident. But our brain was damaged in that process. It happened a while ago, and that connection has not been healed. So we put her on estrogen, life-changing, did IVF, made embryos, have a baby, and now we know that we're going to need to be on estrogen. And I always say, especially with head injury, maybe things will heal. The brain is so amazing. So maybe things will get better at some point. But with hypo-hypo, let's say it is calorie restriction or you are training for something, it can take years to make the connection restored. And then the last thing I'll say here was also that I believe there's this version of hypothalamic dysfunction. We like to think about it like hypo-hypo is amenorrhea and otherwise all good. But there's certainly a level, and this is where I feel like a lot of people see that first stage of ovulatory dysfunction, which is the luteal phase, short luteal phase spotting, that slight ovulatory dysfunction, that's stage one. And we know that. We know that from prolactin studies. That's the first stage in ovulatory dysfunction. You have luteal phase issues and then shorter cycles, then longer cycles, and then amenorrhea. So this hypothalamic dysfunction is where the signal from the hypothalamus is getting blunted because of this stress inflammatory interference. And that's definitely real. And why we see improvement when people get healthier or change their life, it's multifaceted. But to get to the heart of why you might have hypo-hypo could help answer your question about how do you get your brain to start connecting those pathways again and turn back on so that later down the road, you can hopefully get back to an ovulatory pattern. All right, we're going to answer one more question. And before we jump into it, I just want to tell you one more time. Check out the website at nataliecrawfordmd.com for the resources, the newsletter, and the courses. We have so many exciting things coming out. I want you to sign up for the newsletter to stay involved, especially with Pinnacle. Pinnacle is our Women in Medicine conference. We have our annual meeting in May this year in Austin, but we are announcing so many big things at that meeting. So especially if you're a woman in medicine, sign up for the Pinnacle newsletter or follow us. And if you want to call and leave your own question, 657-229-3672. Again, 657-229-3672.
Hi, Dr. Crawford. My name is Christina, and I love your podcast. I found it after I had a miscarriage, and it's been a great support for me. I got to say, I'm woefully uninformed, even though I'm a nurse, about the fertility arena, and it has been super helpful for me. My question, I actually have two. My situation is I'm considering IVF in Taiwan, and Taiwan is known for fertility treatment in the Asian world. I have family there. It's affordable, about 10 grand, and so it gives me a lot more options. They said it would be a 3-week procedure, and my question is, I get really bad jet lag. It's a 14-hour difference between Taiwan and Austin, and I was wondering if jet lag, in what ways does jet lag affect IVF treatment outcomes, if there are any? My second question is, what type of considerations or advice do you have for someone like me who's considering doing IVF treatment overseas? Thank you again for the work that you've done. Grateful for any advice that you might have.
These are such great questions when you're thinking about IVF, and especially if you're looking at tourism for IVF. Now, not all countries, not all centers are created equal. And that is so hard. People glamorize, I'm going to this country for IVF, and then it doesn't work. Or you have outcomes and you don't know how to compare them, or the experience ended up just ultimately costing you more than it could have than if you were here, when you put flights and hotel and food and all the things together. So your situation certainly sounds unique because you have family there. And I think that's a huge differentiating factor between somebody just trying to find a cheap place to go for IVF and somewhere where you have support and connections. Also, Taiwan specifically, since that's where you're looking at going, it is one of the Asian countries that is quite advanced. So many countries don't allow, you know, egg freezing, and laws around donor egg can be really limited. Like we now know in the US, when we start to put restrictions on reproductive rights, this includes IVF, and when you can't practice IVF to the full modern capability, many things are going to fall downstream, including not having the best people, technique, equipment. People don't want to practice. Embryologists don't want to practice when they can't do what they're trained to do. So that being said, Taiwan is somewhere that does have more liberal laws. And part of this is that they do have a very low birth rate. And part of this is because of a high cost of living. They get married later. And so their IVF clinics are really working hard. And the government has now had a subsidy to try to help people get pregnant by doing IVF. And when you see that, that means that more people will be coming into clinics and there's going to be more investment in the space as well. Ultimately, when you look at traveling, the 3-week process, I'm presuming they're talking about a fresh transfer. That may or may not be something that is right for you, so make sure you know the game plan. If it is, then I would recommend you get there earlier, just because adjustment and time and getting your bearings before diving in. IVF itself, we think about IVF, we think about embryo transfer. If we separate them out, where IVF is the act of growing eggs, taking them out and fertilizing them, and then an embryo transfer is putting an embryo in your body. The embryo transfer can be fresh in the same cycle, meaning that embryo was never ever frozen, or frozen, meaning the embryos got frozen and then were thawed back at a later time. If you are doing cycles and you have a fresh embryo, then we do worry more about the impact of stress, jet lag, shift work, and ultimately the stress on your body from something like an immense jet lag. If we're just talking about IVF, we're not worried about it. I'm overriding your brain hormones. You can be tired, but I can get the eggs to grow. I'm not worried about the egg quality. Getting your body to be ready to accept an embryo is a totally different deal. Stress in general can impact success rates. Stress is very hard to quantify. Every person is so different. And that's why there's not a book of recommendations that's the same for everybody. I always say, you need to know you. Maybe acupuncture, maybe it's walks with the birds, maybe it's time outside or with your family or a book or a bath. Everybody is different. You need to carve out time in your day, cut back on the crazy, lower your stress hormones. I do love that if you're a nurse, you're working hard. So going away is going to be a break from probably a lot of your hustle and bustle. But if there's a way to swing getting there earlier so that the jet lag won't be as rough, or upgrading the flight, trying to sleep on it, trying to adjust better, definitely think about that full experience and what it will be like if you're trying to have a fresh embryo transfer and not freezing the embryos to do a frozen transfer later. Ultimately, though, wish you the best. It's never an easy decision, but do your due diligence. Research the place you want to go. Know who works there, where they were trained, what their success rates are, and just feel confident in your decision. And I love that you have family, so if you can leverage staying with them and getting support, I think that's amazing. to all of the people listening, IVF tourism is definitely becoming a bigger thing. Whether it's just to find a doctor who cares for you or to go to a place that feels like a better environment. We are seeing more patients than ever come to us. We're at Fora Fertility in Austin, Texas, and we take care of patients from all over the country and all over the world. So as people are able to have more ability to research places and learn more about who they're seeing, you're able to make a more educated decision. So at the end of the day, do what's best for you. All right, friends. Well, I hope this episode helped you learn a little bit about IVF and get some of your questions answered. We had a really diverse group of questions, so I loved it. These episodes are my favorite. If the whole podcast could be just us hanging out and talking, that's what I would do. But it only works if you call and leave a question. So the number is 657-229-3672. Again, that is 657-229-3672. You can always follow along on Instagram at Natalie Crawford MD. Check out the website, nataliecrawfordmd.com, and check us out on YouTube. Thanks, friends. Thank you all for listening to As a Woman. It would mean so much if you could rate, review, and follow the podcast to be notified of new episodes every Sunday. I hope you learned something new, and I hope you share it with someone in your life. Be sure to follow along on Instagram at Natalie Crawford MD, and check out the YouTube channel Natalie Crawford MD. If you're interested in becoming a patient, you can also follow Fora Fertility. I'm so thrilled to have you here, part of the community that amplifies others as a woman.
Hey guys, welcome to The Collective. I'm Brianne Helfrich, a 26-year-old bioethics PhD student and clothing brand CEO. Welcome to my podcast where we talk all things health and wellness, navigating your 20s, and becoming the best version of yourself. So sit down, play that episode, and join The Collective.